You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Antoine Atti. I'm a senior economist with the Revenue Watch Institute. And I'm pleased to welcome you for this brown bag lunch on the report on transparency and progress in Nigeria. Today we have three speakers with us. On my left, Imeri Von Kemedy, who is the head of the New Process Office in the government of Bayelsa State, and is also the chairman of the Bayelsa Expenditure and Income Transparency Initiative, which is a new institution that Von may explain a little more about that we have been supporting as Revenue Watch from a technical angle. On my right, I have Asume Isaac Suswoka, who is the director of Social Action, which is an NGO based in Port Harcourt that works on citizen engagement on energy, mining, trade, and investment. And he's also the founder and chairman of the Niger Delta Citizens Budget Platform, which is a coalition of NGOs working on budget transparency and access to information in four Nigerian states in the Delta that we have also been supporting over the last year. And far further to my left, we have Alexandra Gillis, who is a PhD candidate in international relations at the University of Cambridge. And she's working more specifically on the political economy of the oil sector reform in Africa, with a specific focus on Nigeria. She's been doing a lot of field work in Nigeria in the last year, and has done some interesting work, published and unpublished, on transparency in oil. The idea of this small panel is to have a very informal conversation. So I'll try to ask questions to our presenters and then try to open up the discussion for questions. So the focus here, I mean, is to try to assess, you know, what are the recent developments on transparency and the governance of oil and gas revenues in Nigeria. So my first question would be for Von, to try and understand, you know, how you, sitting in the Bayelsa State government, what trends can you see at the state and maybe at the national level in terms of progress or obstacles towards pushing for greater transparency in the oil and gas revenues?
Thank you very much. I think that there have been some setbacks with regards to anti-corruption in Nigeria, particularly with the unfortunate inability of the EFCC to prosecute former leaders of Nigeria who were involved in misspending resources in the country. But I think also that on the other hand, a lot of progress has been made in ensuring that current revenues in the country are better managed. I believe that the current government at the federal level has been better at managing resources. But where it gets even more exciting is in Bayelsa State, where I believe the doors are all open for all of us here to push back and test how far we are willing to go as a government in instituting transparency. Isaac and I worked a lot together on a number of things when we were all in civil society. And I think one of the last ideas we were working on was the Niger Delta Citizens Budget Platform. If I don't get it right, then you just understand how long ago I was looking at these things. And I think that we were very lucky that for an idea that we wanted to implement as a civil society intervention, we now have the opportunity with myself been centrally involved in the Bayelsa state government to work from from within. And basically, this really was the origin of the Bayelsa expenditure and income transparency initiative. Karen was very kind in arranging for a meeting between my governor, Chief Silva, and George Soros in Senegal, where they had very good discussions and then agreed to implement this project. I would have hoped that we should have made much more progress. Things were a bit slow. But right now, I think things are getting on a much more firmer footing. The multi-stakeholder working group has been set up, consisting of myself, the Commissioner for Finance, Commissioner for Justice, and that for Health and Information on the government side. Also, the State Assembly is represented by two members, the Chairman for the Appropriations Committee and the other Chairman of Public Accounts Committee are members of the multi-stakeholder working group, which also includes membership from the oil companies, Statoil, AGIP, and Shell, and five civil society members representing the INC, IYC, and three NGOs in Bayelsa.
Can you tell us what's the objective of the BEIT?
Since this morning, the objectives have expanded a bit, at least in my head. But the main objective is to make available information on the income and expenditure of Bayelsa state government so that it can form a basis for debate and discussion around the implementation of the state's budget. And also, the initiative aims to open up the budget-making process so that people don't only have to debate the implementation of the budget, but have access to the policy forum where the budgets are agreed. And of course, then participating in monitoring and evaluating the performance of the budget through looking at the figures released by the government and discussing what these figures mean in terms of meeting the priorities of the people of Bayelsa State. And one other angle that that I'm very excited about is that it not only opens up the books of the Bayelsa State government, but because we are looking through the lens of the Bayelsa State Sustainable Development Strategy at the coordination of all spending in Bayelsa State. And since we have invited the oil companies to be part of the stakeholder working group, we expect that they will similarly be open to making available information regarding their own expenditure as far as at least Bayelsa State development projects are concerned.
Thank you. Now, Isaac, I mean, when you see, I mean, this progress, interesting initiative in Bayelsa, how do you assess, I mean, this interesting initiative compared to other, you know, situation? I mean, you're working in Delta, in Rivers, in Akwa Ibom, so how do you assess Bayelsa performance compared to others? And second, you know, what? How do you see the role of civil society in taking advantage of initiatives like the one that Bon has mentioned, and you know, further opportunities that you would like to see in order to enable your work and inputs in this process?
Let me also add, apart from the points that Bon just made, that there have been maybe other opportunities in Nigeria. In 2007, there was a transition from one civilian government to the other, and in the history of Nigeria, it's the first time that a post-independent government, conducted an election and actually handed power over to new. It was thought to be, you know, something impossible. So, despite the fact that there are still a lot of problems in Nigeria, we don't hear rumors about coup d'etats being planned or not being planned, meaning that we now have the possibility of actually looking at our country, at the political process, at the democratic process, and see how we can actually work to deepen and strengthen it. There have been some very clear improvements in Bayelsa, for example, with the initiative that Von talked about. We also saw in Bayelsa the idea of the due process office, where contracts by government are subjected to, or are supposed to be subjected to, some level of scrutiny by an office. Within Nigeria, I've had complaints by people who I can identify as political contractors, who are complaining that they don't have as much access to money as they used to have in the past administrations. And for me, particularly, I see that as some progress. That it might mean that money is not being thrown around. Also, apart from Bayelsa, the new government in Rivers State and Delta, and even Akwa Ibom, have made some, at least verbal, commitments to being more transparent about the way they organize their budgets. Interestingly, a few months ago, we organized a town hall meeting in River State to discuss the government budget, the state government and local government, with the government and citizens groups. The government sent a very, in Nigerian parlance, a high-powered delegation made up of three commissioners. And that showed some level of, that they appreciated the need to engage with citizens at that level. However, these are opportunities that we need to build on, because the crisis that we are confronted with are very deep, and they've been with us for 50 years and more. It's also a crisis related to what some will call the resource cost, and I'm sure that we'll hear a little bit later from our academic colleague on that. For us, in trying to deepen this process that have begun to consolidate on the gains, we also have to think of the issues of power itself, political power and political representation. Even though there was a transition from one civilian government to the other, I think that there is a basic consensus as to the fact, I think, that the elections were not just flawed, but that in many parts of the Delta in particular, there were no elections at all. And so those who are now in government, those who are governors or members of the state legislatures, or in particular the local government councils, have not been elected by the people, by anybody, because they didn't contest elections. Elections results have been basically written down at some offices or some beer palace somewhere. And so the result is that there is no sense of responsibility or sense of accountability on the part of political office holders at the legislature or at the local government councils, and also at the state executive council, because the people do not have the right to suffrage has been eliminated. And so we need to, as we're working on budget, we also need to understand the need for, say, electoral reforms to ensure that in 2011 we can have some level of popular will expressed in the way the kind of people that emerge as government. We, in the work that we have done at the level of the platform in the past year, included monitoring of a few projects that have been budgeted by the different states. Specifically, we're talking about the four states, Akwa Ibom, Rivers, Delta, and Bayelsa. And even though we noticed from our analysis and monitoring that it was easier to assess budgets from Bayelsa in particular, we were able to assess the budgets officially from the due process office. In other states, that was not the case. We had to obtain budgets using informal means. In terms of how the different regimes in the states are working to implement the budget, we noticed that there's still very much business as usual. Business as usual in the sense that citizens of the states do not feel the impact of the development benefits from those budgets. And I must also add that those budgets have been substantial in terms of the amount, which is the result of the record increases in oil prices, you know, in particularly period from 2007 to 2008. A state like River State expended over $3 billion last year. But if you ask the people, they don't feel that there is any impact of that huge expenditure. What we want to look at, you know, the areas where budgets have stated that work would be done. In some cases, we saw very minimal work. Evaluators will assess, you know, sometimes best case 30% work done at the end of the year. In most cases, no work at all. For example, in River State, a school for the handicapped was supposed to be renovated. Hostels were supposed to be built and renovated with 10 million naira. But when we got to that, yeah, at the end of the year, there was no attempt at even visiting the school to update, you know, upgrade any facility. Inmates who are disabled, you know, physically challenged individuals are forced to sleep too in a very small bed, you know, in very, you know, scrappy environment. And if you examine the budgets of 2007, 2008, and 2009, you find that that item continued to record renovation of borderless, you know, school for the handicapped, but absolutely no work done. You know, our conclusion is that somebody has stolen that money. You go to local government councils where there's some budget for provision of firefighting, you know, fire extinguishers, and you discover that the only fire extinguisher that, you know, that you have in the local government secretariat was bought maybe sometime during the military era. And nothing of that sort exists, because Nigerians don't pay attention to fire extinguishers anyway that much, because it's not, I mean, people are thinking about how to survive, you know. And so those are like budgets become an avenue to basically steal theoretical documents that, you know, just facilitate stealing. In Bayelsa State, we discovered that for example, the specialist hospital work was going on, even though delayed. But there are other projects like, is it motherless baby's home at Opolo, where no work was done. You go to the ministry and you speak to directors of the ministry responsible for those kind of projects, and they tell you that they are not even aware that such a project exists. But it's the state's budget. You examine local government budget and you see projects that, you know, bus parks, motor parks, we call it in Nigeria, are supposed to be built. In some cases, even recorded in the budget as having been completed the previous year. And you go to the site, you know, or you go to the community, and nothing of that sort exists. You know, and these are like patterns that you find in all the state budgets. So there's still a lot of work that we still need to do, you know, to translate, you know, to tap from the opportunities that have been created, you know, to like actually deepen them in the way that and manner that implementation is carried out, because that is also very critical.
Now, Alex, I mean, we have sort of mixed view on progress, or at least some opportunities, but I mean, being far from sufficient in terms of actual change for on the ground in terms of development and improvement in welfare of the people. Now, if you contrast it with your view, which has been, as I understand, more at the federal level, how do you see, I mean, you know, the general trends at the federal level in terms of transparency, at least in two ways. One is looking at the NICE, which had been, I think, one of the examples in the past, meaning 2004, 2005, but still, you know, seen as a good example. And now, going through, I think, a tough time. That's my first question. And second, now we are talking about major reforms in the petroleum sector in Nigeria. And I wonder, I mean, not talking about all the implications of the reform, but what does this potential reform implies for corruption and transparency in the oil and gas sector?
Thanks very much for inviting me as well. I think it might be helpful to kind of take a small step back and think about the value chain, which is the term used for... So the resource curse phenomenon was identified, and now what you find among academics and policy institutions is they say to combat the resource curse, you need to improve governance and transparency across the so-called value chain of these products. So the first stage is kind of the generation of the... is the awarding of contracts, so it's kind of the production phase. Then you've got the regulation of how that industry takes place, the collection of the revenues by the government, the way in which those revenues are budgeted, managed, allocated, and then kind of the expenditure themselves. So there are reforms that have to take place along this entire value chain in order for the kind of economic and political negative effects associated with the resource curse to be avoided. And there's a growing recognition of what best practice might look like along the value chain. And in Nigeria, there's been efforts at progress at each stage. I think the work that Vaughn and Isaac is doing in different ways is extremely important because it addresses that final stage, the expenditure stage, which is perhaps one of the most difficult to address, but also the one that has the most impact on people's everyday lives. So you can have some problems with, you know, the contracting process with oil companies on this end that doesn't have the same kind of immediate developmental effects that the kind of expenditure policy does at this end of the value chain. And it's proven a difficult area to address in Nigeria. Obviously, civil society should be playing a role in monitoring how spending takes place, and they need the information to be able to do that. But this is also a role that the legislature is supposed to be playing, and also kind of accountability offices within the executive itself, both at the federal and the state level, such as the due process office that Vaughn heads up. And I would say, you know, across the board, at the federal and state level, there have been some interesting efforts, but no kind of coherent change in the way that revenues are expended and the ability for those actors I just mentioned to monitor the expenditures. So I think experiments like the one that like Beatty in Bielsa State, and also the civil society work, the monitoring work that you're doing, is extremely important to figure out how these actors can start to get a handle on where the money's going and to what use. The reforms that Antoine mentioned kind of occur in the middle phases of the value chain, and I can talk about those briefly. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative in Nigeria is called NEITI, or NEITI, and it got off to a great start, as Antoine mentioned, in 2004. And published this incredible audit of the Nigerian oil sector. Its scope far exceeded the international requirements associated with the EITI, and it represents completely unrivaled document on the Nigerian oil sector. There's so little information available, and then here comes this report that is just massive in the amount of information it contains. The problem is that since the release of that report in 2006, the activity levels at NATI have declined dramatically. And the next audit was supposed, the first audit covered 1999 to 2004. The second audit was supposed to cover the year of 2005, and we're still waiting for it. And it's now kind of the middle of 2009. And there are a number of kind of institutional and political reasons why I think NATI's gotten off track, and we can get into those if people are interested. But the most important thing is that this institution had a lot of potential to produce information that's very useful to a wide range of actors inside and outside of government, and it's falling short. The second reform that you mentioned was this effort to restructure Nigeria's oil sector. The sector's a bit of a mess, the way it's governed. There's a number of institutions who have overlapping roles and responsibilities, lots of conflicts of interest among the national oil company, the regulator, the ministries, and in general, the lack of efficiency and order, creating the kind of environment in which corruption and leakages are able to thrive. This has been known for a long time, and efforts to improve the structure started back in the mid-80s. And so far, this agenda has gained no traction in the country, despite a number of, I think, pretty genuine efforts. The technical complexity of fixing these things is one barrier, but also the very formidable political and economic vested interests that have risen up over time around the status quo, I think have been the principal barrier to moving forward. At the moment, a bit surprisingly, there is an agenda or an effort to restructure the sector and how it's governed. This is kind of the upstream sector, not the revenue part as much. And there's a bill, the petroleum industry bill, before the National Assembly right now, which in theory tries to create some order and increase the kind of oversight and transparency in the sector through a restructuring. I think it's still very much up in the air as to where this agenda is going and whether it will move forward. You could see a few scenarios, one in which somehow they're able to overcome the political obstacles and implement this program. I think another more likely scenario is the bill gets passed, but implementation is compromised to some kind of extent, so that you've got new institutions who may be better than the last ones, but still, you've got political agendas compromising their effectiveness. So we can come back to any of these issues that people are interested in.
Well, I guess I'd rather open the floor for discussions right now, so that people can ask specific questions to the issues that all the panelists have outlined. So the floor is now open.
Hi, I'm Sandy Colliver, and I'm with the Justice Initiative. We're looking at transparency from the freedom of information side. I'm very interested in Bayelsa State, and I'm interested, what do you think has been the circumstances that have enabled or motivated the government to be more transparent? And it sounds like that might be kind of fragile, but that it seems like they're going in the right direction. Regarding the e-governance bureau and the transparency of contracts, does this mean that all of the oil contracts are available? And I'm very interested in that, because my understanding is that most of the contracts for oil are very difficult to get. And then also with since it's e-governance, I guess that means that you have a lot on the website. And then is there also a kind of a separate process just for filing information requests?
Okay, thanks a lot. We don't deal with oil contracts. The oil belongs to the federal government, although Isaac and I do not agree about that. we agree that the oil belongs to someone else, not the federal government. So the federal government manages the oil. We don't deal with that.
the contracts we deal with are contracts for projects implemented by the Bayelsa State government. And we do keep records of that. Sometimes a ministry, department, or agency will ask for, they will request for, in one particular case, they asked for 250 million naira. And by the time we went through the process, we found that all they needed was 1 point something million naira. So there was a difference of more than 150 million. Last year, what was saved was equivalent to, through this process, was equivalent to 24% of the budget. Now, the office that I work for is called the Due Process and E-Governance Bureau. So the due process side takes care of looking at the contracting process to make sure that the price and the process is right. We've been on for 2 years now. We've not really concerned ourselves so much with the process. We've been focused more on the price. But hopefully when e-governance is fully deployed, we expect to make even more gains from that sector than from due process. Because just by having the budgets online, just by posting all contracts online and making sure that payments by cash are stopped so that all the transactions pass through a process that can easily be audited, making sure that there is no case of missing files and things like that, we expect the system to improve. So I will say that in terms of improvements in transparency in Bayelsa State, this is just the beginning, because between the due process mechanism, BAT, and e-governance, we expect a lot of improvements. The stated objective of the governor is to reduce his powers. That's really how he sees it, that by these things we do, we minimize his capacity for discretion and therefore reduce the pressure on him. And I think we've already achieved that significantly. Everybody now knows that there are lots of things the governor cannot do, and a lot of the blame is deflected. Everybody blames Vaughn for whatever goes. it's a typical thing to do. Even everybody just, the first thing in the morning is Vaughn is a bad person, last thing in the night is the same story. But since I'm really not in the mainstream politics, that's easy to absorb. But when Isaac was talking, I thought about this connection, and I think this is a connection that it's important for us to look at a bit more. Maybe for Alex to dip in if she can today or later. Between transparency and electoral integrity, there's a very strong connection there, and perhaps it's better to focus a lot more on instituting transparency than on the electoral reforms. Because one thing that I can already see clearly is that the less money you have in politics, the more transparent the expenditures are, the less money there is for people. Already there are many commissioners in my state who are very unhappy. They will say, why is this nonsense happening during my time? You know, everybody becomes a commissioner, and after a while, you become very rich. And now it has become suddenly so difficult to get money out of the system. So what that means is that the next election should be better, because it's easier for the opposition to challenge the incumbent. They don't need too much money to challenge the incumbent. And of course, it's also easier for people to have access to resources, particularly if the selection process for contractors is improved through the due process mechanism, so that even people who may not be friendly with the government, if they are good at what they do, can have access to contracts. If we have that sort of situation, then it will go a long way to mitigate this
problem in an oil economy where you don't really have many options in terms of access to capital apart from the oil economy, which is completely controlled by the government. So I think these are various areas that we can work around. And I just also want to use this opportunity to say that everybody here should make at least one effort to be in Bielsa, or to send someone to Bielsa, because and that comes always, but we want Karen there as well. We want everybody, because I say this because we know the counter pressure to what we are doing. The counter pressure to what we are doing is huge, and I one thing that keeps us going on the positive direction is the kind of good reviews that we receive from everywhere. And also the fact that we now understand that we have staked something very high. This is a big gamble. Because if on top of all these reviews and everything, if something really goes wrong, then it's going to be the end of hope. And so I believe that the ways in which we work to strengthen, particularly the demand side, civil society, I don't really feel that we need a lot from anybody to do what we are doing. We have as a government what it takes to do what we are doing, but what's more important and what I'm worried about is the state of civil society in Bielsa State. I'm not expected to go and do civil society work and do government work at the same time. Yeah. And sometimes I find myself tempted to criticize government because we are not doing as well as we could. Really, there is no... We do not have... Antoine knows this very well. We don't have strong capacity in our civil society organizations in Bielsa State. I do not know of any NGO in Yenagoa that has a functional office with good internet access, meeting spaces, not to mention salary kept aside for 3 workers for a 6-month period. This is where we really need support so that we can grow the demand side of this equation.
Bielsa has obviously suffered like everyone else, every other oil producer, from the decline in oil prices relative to the last few years. What's the process been by which the government has decided what to cut or what programs to reduce or hold back or delay or eliminate?
I think this has actually been an advantage. It's a good thing that we have less money because it has forced some extra thinking on us. The budget for this year, which was just approved a few weeks ago, is 190 billion naira, which is obviously very unreasonable. It's actually more than the budget for last year. So probably someone knows where some money will come from that the rest of us do not know. But now we all in the government, we see that it doesn't make sense for us to have a 190 billion naira budget. So the state economic team is now organizing a review of the budget along the lines that you are mentioning. And we have looked at giving greater priority to projects that will save money. That means that my office get to get better funding. And then also priority to projects that will make money. If within the year, better. In the future, that's fine as well. This, of course, does not affect education and health projects, which their positive effect is much more long-term. Health means that people live longer, and we retain their experience to grow the economy, and apart of course from the fact that it's good for people to live as long as they can. So we use this sort of order to determine which projects stay on the budget and which will be removed. And I think the process is still on, but I hope that within the next week or two we will conclude that process. And then once that is done, we have an option. If we send the budget back to the House of Assembly, it may be distorted, or they try to add more things. And that's why our budget for this year was high. They added some things by themselves. So now if we use this method, we simply have the budget there, but the priorities are clear to the budget office. Because budget clearance has to be given before any project is implemented. So the budget office will know this. And then the due process office also, one of the things we look at for is budget clearance before a project is implemented. And so we will have these projects, the priority projects, in our system, and then we'll be able to look at them before they pass. And one of the things that is responsible for the situation Isaac mentioned about you go to somewhere and you don't see a project implemented is that in one scenario, the amount of money budgeted is not really available. So you say you want to spend 190 billion, but at the end of the year, you actually got only 150 billion. So certain projects don't get implemented. And the ones that don't get implemented are the most important projects. You know, those projects that will lead to social development, economic development, those are the ones that don't get funded. But the ones that have patrons, mm-hmm. roads to nowhere, and things like that, those ones get quickly funded. But the advantage of tightening the budget is that then at least everything gets funded, because what you budget for is the money that's actually available.
Hi, Ed Cashy. Vaughn, when's the next election for the governorships?
Where?
In Nigeria?
In Nigeria. In Nigeria, it's 2011.
Okay, so this was a 4-year term. So you're roughly halfway through Governor Silva's...
No, ours is different.
Okay.
Ours is still 2012.
So 5 years.
That was a bonus year.
Okay. Because I'm just wondering how this very ambitious, you know, and wonderful agenda, how you organized it within that context. Because I assume that, you know, well, I don't know how it is in Nigeria, but here you would already be starting your re-election campaign. Yeah. But, you know, at what point will you feel you have enough progress to show? I guess I don't know if we can assume that he will go for re-election, but, you know, how do you create continuity? I guess that's what I'm looking for. How do you ensure that there will be continuity regardless of what happens in the next election, and at what point do you have to start thinking about trying to preserve whatever progress you have made in this period of time?
I think that's where the difficulty is. Because the reforms that were instituting are not that popular. I remember speaking to someone about this, about Beatty, and this is somebody who is not a government official, is not a contractor or anything, and what she said was, this is dangerous. So some people are not comfortable with this, and also there's not a lot of money on the streets anymore. In previous governments, there was a special budget for funerals, for birthday parties, for people who want to go for weekend and they need maybe just like small amount of money, like 2 million for the weekend and things like that. So previous governments, they had this. So a lot of money was on the streets, people had access to quick money. Now, the system is different here. Unfortunately, if you have to deliver on development, then you have less free money to spread around. So I hope that we do well with getting people to understand the link between lack of money on the streets and the projects that we are delivering that they are seeing. we expect the 2012 elections to be very tough because in 2011, the elections all over the country are over. And so in 2012, everybody will now focus on Bielsa. And it's going to be very, very difficult to play any games with that election. And also, of course, the political class, the people in Abuja, are part of the group of people who are not happy. So even the PDP primaries is not going to be easy for the governor. So it's a bit challenging, but we are hoping that at the end of the day we will come up with strategies that will help us create another four-year opportunity for us to continue. I'm fairly confident that we will be reelected. Fairly confident about that, except that it's going to be a much more challenging situation.
Yeah. Talking about elections, it's usually, and I'm sure this is the same elsewhere, but in Nigeria, the character of expenditure by government, whether federal or state, can be determined whether it's 1 year to election or 2 years to election. We discovered that immediately after elections, new governments tend to want to gain some level of legitimacy. Level of legitimacy in the sense that they didn't win the election in the first place. You know, they got the victory, you know, organized by the ruling party through the electoral commission. So they sometimes need to use certain processes and programs to gain some legitimacy from the people. But however, when we begin to approach the election year, there's a tendency for the expenditure to reflect that basically settling, you know, those who are powerful, who have powerful political interests. And this is also happening because the citizens themselves don't determine who becomes governor. You know, at least they have not in the past two elections that we've had. And so those who you spend money on are the powerful politicians in Abuja or those who are connected to them. If we have a situation where the citizens of the state, the people in the communities, are properly informed about budget processes, and if there's need for some austerity measure, they are aware of how, you know, that is happening. It means that a governor, Bielsa or anywhere, can move into an election year without thinking so much about settling politicians and just wasting public money for that, knowing that he or she will have the trust of the people. There have been some reports recently in some media that the governor of Bielsa was on radio suggesting that because of the situation, the reduced revenue, that the government will no longer be paying money to militants. I don't know how true that, but this is what has been in the media, quoting the governor in a radio discussion. And so that means that there may have been some level of payment to militants or armed elements. And, I mean, I know for certain that those who are called militants, who are involved in hostage taking or whatever, have continued to receive substantial amounts of money from the governors in the core Niger Delta states. In many cases, the governors themselves created those and armed people for political purposes. So there's maybe one of the good things that because there's less money, there's maybe less to give out to maybe either to mobilize militants or to keep them quiet so that they don't disturb production and the revenue that gets. So there's work to be done, I mean, the point that Vaughn made about civil society is very correct. The formal civil society sector in Bayelsa is weak relative to, I mean, compared to other states like River State, mostly because Bayelsa is a relatively new state that was carved out of River State. Bayelsa is more rural, and so even civil servants who are working in Bayelsa State sometimes reside in Port Harcourt. Anyway, so but there are clear changes that I imagine. Bayelsa people, including civil servants, are moving, you know, to Bayelsa more than before. And we're also seeing, you know, NGOs imagine that are showing some promise in this kind of interventions. But for some of us, NGOs, civil society is not just composed of NGOs. You know, there are a broad spectrum of citizens, actors that are, you know, part of civil society. They're the community. No, not PDP. You know, and so there should be a way to utilize those organizations and basically get them to know what is going on with government. Just lastly, you know, about the NATI, the progress that was, you know, were recorded in NATI implementation in Nigeria, and the subsidence of action in the past few years. Personally, I just say what is responsible for that will be Ezekwesili. Because of the limitations of the Nigerian political system, sometimes we need certain individuals to champion processes. And in the case of the NATI, when Obiageli Ezekwesili was involved in that process, it was possible for her to push it through, you know, and not just push it, you know, in terms of the implementation, but also to get an enabling legislation to back up the work. Since Obiageli left that process, you know, we're not seeing that, you know, much vigor in the work. You know, I was mentioning just a few minutes ago that Obiageli went on to the Solid Minerals Ministry in Nigeria, and she succeeded in getting a Minerals Act that, in our view, is very progressive. You know, and we at the NGO side don't always, you know, applaud what government people do, but that law is an example of what, to some large extent, what legislation in this sector should look like. It may seem that in Bayelsa we have a governor who also shows that kind of promise as an individual who can push a process through. But the powers, the way Nigerian politics unfortunately has been organized is that, you know, his powers are very limited. You know, for example, a situation where the state assembly will, you know, pass a budget, appropriation that is so unrealistic, and the governor cannot effectively communicate with them. That means that there are some problems there. There are people who have been former governors in the state who are now the presidency of the Federal Republic, and therefore closer to the leadership of the ruling party. You know, how much did those individuals steal in Bayelsa when they were governor, for example? Is it possible that Bayelsa, you know, the crisis of revenue or the limit that to the revenue of Bayelsa State is informed not just by the oil price, but certain debts that have been incurred by the ex-governor to in the past, you know, and what happened to all the debts the loans that were collected? How did Bayelsa get so bankrupt even before this regime? So these are broader issues that we need to also consider. And so that is why we need to consider how elections are organized. We need to consider how we can use the budget process to, you know, galvanize citizens' response to politics in the first place. Because talking about the resource cost, you know, when a government becomes dependent on taxation, you know, rents from oil companies, you don't need the people. You know, you don't need the people, you don't need their taxes. You know, whether or not they're paying taxes is not important, because at the end of the day, you have your revenue. whether the people are engaged in productive ventures is not important, because you don't, your survival is not dependent on production on the part of the people. So that disconnect is there, that has been created by dependence on oil. So we need to use the budget process to reconnect the people and the state and the government.
Yeah, just let me just make one point about this. It relates to things said by both of you. And this is the idea of, you know, creating reform coalitions or actors who are able to advocate on behalf of reforms. And if you look at the NATI, it's true that the reason for its initial success was largely because it had a politically empowered, highly energetic, and competent person that was making sure it exceeded everyone's expectations. And then when she left, there was no other force that filled the gap that remained. But I think that there's not, and maybe the similar case could be made for Governor Silva and people like Vaughn, who are pushing the reforms in Bielsa State. But when you look at issues of sustainability, you can't just kind of sit back and wait for these reform champions to emerge from the system and then see what they can do, because there's real sustainability risks. I think the challenge is to create demand coalitions that have some clout within the system. You have civil society, and yes, it has some serious capacity issues that constrain its ability to play that role. But also systemically, I think it often lacks the kind of influence that enables it to determine policy outcomes. So it needs to be part of the equation, but I don't think it's enough to form a whole reform coalition just of NGOs. And I can think of with the NATI, and this is an institution that produces information about really high quality information about the oil sector. The number of audiences who should be interested in that information extends far beyond NGOs. It should be the petroleum committees on the legislatures, it should be private sector, it should be investors, it should be oil and gas lawyers. Like, all of these people should be PhD students looking at the oil sector. Like, there's no information about this sector out there. So there should be lots of people clamoring for NATI to perform the way it should. But the problem is that there hasn't been anyone kind of selling NATI in that light, saying, you know, look, House of Representatives, Petroleum Committee, this institution could be producing all this valuable information, but it's not. Don't you want to go find out what's happening and kind of put a little influence into this process? So I think that kind of strategic, diverse demand creation around procurement reform or around transparency issues is really needed, because you can't just wait for the champions to emerge.
Could you say, both of you say a little something about the role of local government authorities in this whole mix, in Bielsa, for example?
Well, in Bielsa, local governments have been not very effective. And this is due to a variety of reasons. For instance, the local government chairpersons, because in Bielsa they are all women, they don't stay in their headquarters. They stay in the city. And so they only go back once a month to pay salaries. And salaries constitute close to between 80 to 90% of the expenditure. So while you actually have the problem of mismanagement of resources, increasingly you are also having the problem of, it's like you set up a company and the company spends 90% of its income on managing the company, which does not really make sense.
Yeah.
But we are hoping that we are going to drill it down to the local government level, so the same thing happens there. And the new commissioner for local government and rural development has been very proactive. They are looking to make sure that every local government has a budget, which they do not normally have. They will just execute projects according to the whim of the commissioner. Also, we are hoping that through a statewide human resource data gathering process, we will be able to put the ghost workers to rest. If we're able to put the ghost to rest, then we'll be able to recover some of the money that we are going to the ghost. And hopefully local governments also will have more money to spend for development purposes.
There has been major shift in the attention or focus of community people and activists in the Delta in the past decade, I think. First, there was a focus on oil companies as the problem. And you will see that properly, you know, clearly expressed in the documents that came from, say, the Movement for Survival of Ogoni People and Sarawewa and the Joint Council. And then at that same period, there was a attempt to identify the Nigerian state as basically Lagos or Abuja, which was a problem to the Delta as well. In very recent times, we are trying to look inward to the states because they're part of the state, you know, the state government, the local government, what are they doing with the revenue that they get. You discover that in the case of the local government, it's appalling, you know, the level of corruption, you know, just apart from the salaries, and that includes ghost workers, in many cases, a whole 4 years, you know, local government chairmen and their sponsors basically chop everything, you know, and the local government are supposed to be autonomous by the Nigerian constitution, that they top the entire of government. So the state governors and the state governments have even limited control over local government because there's, you know, and all that. So we need to focus a little bit more on local governance. I see that for a long time, the idea of local governance has not been properly structured in Nigeria in a way that it would be useful to the people. And that may be because of the long years of military rule, where local governments were basically administrative outposts of the center. I mean, that was even this more or less the same situation during colonialism, but it was particularly so during the military regimes. Because we've had so much, you know, time spent on that military regime, people don't, that level of government that affects people's life, you know, people don't see it that way. Now, I used to tell people, you know, my observation, you know, as somebody growing up from a rural community where adults pay some level, I mean, some taxes, some contributions for community development, whether it's to build a community toilet or to build a town hall. You have a situation where whatever money is collected by the community for those purposes is as much as possible, you know, used for those purposes. The possibility of embezzlement is reduced to the barest minimum because people are contributing, you know, and they want to ensure that they see what is done with their money. But in the case of local government, people don't feel that connection because they don't, they see it as just people who are being, you know, installed by other powers. And so even though you will rather die than see the community chief steal your contribution for community development, the same community has somebody who is a chairman of the local government area, and he's building these monstrous mansions everywhere, and nobody pays any attention to what you know, nobody asks any question. And so maybe one aspect, you know, that we have at other levels, apart from budget work that we are advocating, is that there should be thorough local restructuring of local government systems that sees a direct involvement of community leadership structures, like the community development committees, in the local government administration itself. So we can see that more responsibility and more transparency in the way local government function and, you know, affect the lives of the people.
One last question.
Oh, I have two questions. So I'll give you both questions and then you can decide. The first one is about asset declarations. And I wonder if a campaign that sought to promote compliance with asset declarations might address some part of this issue of corruption. And I'm asking in particular because the World Bank is putting a lot of money into this, and they've just finished a study of 175 countries looking at the number of countries that require asset declarations, and of the 175, 109 do, and of the 109 that do, how many require publicity to the public and not just to the regulators. And my office is starting now to work with the World Bank to see how we can get compliance with asset declarations in those countries that require publicity, but also in those countries that don't require publicity, just to start to open that up. Because the World Bank found that it doesn't really help to have asset declarations that are just given to the regulator if the regulator doesn't have teeth and if the declarations aren't open to the public. But if they are open to the public, that has a significant effect on the perception of corruption. So that's one question. The other question is kind of more immediate. You probably know that the case on behalf of the Movement for the Ngoti People against Shell Oil is going to trial in New York starting at the end of the month. And that's a six-week trial, and it's a very serious and significant case asking for $100 million in damages. But the actual financial amount could be much, much bigger than that. Part of the background is that there was a case brought against Chevron in California. Maybe you know about that as well. And that case failed on behalf of people who had been killed in an incident where the oil company gave helicopters that shot on protesters who were accused of having taken hostages. So I'm wondering, is that case seen to have impact in the Delta region? And I guess it's also a question to Revenue Watch as to whether is this case of interest, and is there some way to increase the impact of this case just by through publicity, through having a Nigerian journalist at the trial, or having people come for a week at least to be able to observe and to carry the information back. So if there's only room time to answer one question, then you could just choose whatever, which one.
I'll say that I will agree completely with the conclusions of the World Bank study on asset declaration. And I will say that maybe we need to also flag that issue more, because in Nigeria, the political office holders are obliged to declare their assets to the Code of Conduct Bureau, and nobody else is supposed to see it. The current president and the vice president decided on their own to declare their assets. They were not obliged by law.
Who was Richard?
The vice president. You know, they were not, you know, obliged by law. But again, people were asking in Nigeria, what about their wife's assets? You know, those might be also maybe more significant than their own assets. But you know, clearly, there's need for transparency. You know, if not, it's not very useful. The Ogoni case.
Just one more point on the asset stuff. It's come up in the press recently in the last couple months regarding the private sector interests of the new petroleum minister. And I think that it got a bit of traction that when he was confirmed by the Senate, they failed to do due diligence about the stakes he had in various oil companies, and it came out in a few newspapers. I don't think anything really came of it, but there was some discussion, at least, that the confirmation process hadn't looked into those issues fully, and there was some attention around what other officials' interests might be in companies.
And I just said part of what the World Bank is in the process of doing is to establish kind of what information needs to be included in asset declarations and what needs to be public. And part of it is the spouses and the dependent children, and part of it is all the conflict of interest categories. So it's asset, income, membership in organizations.
For Nigeria, it's all there. It's all there. The only, it's very, very good. It's just that it's not made public. And if you default, you can be taken to a special tribunal. And if you're in the wrong political camp, then you're finished. So,
I mean, all these things in Nigeria, if the Freedom of Information Bill ever passed, like, all of this stuff would just be infinitely easier to deal with in this area and so many others.
Right. and you may know that. I'm sure that you knew that part of the excitement of the campaign on the FOI bill was to get 1 million signatures in support through the churches. I wonder how active the churches are in civil society and in the Delta as well.
Yes. Now you're getting three questions.
Okay. Yes, that was just kind of a...
You started.
Okay, the second I think that the Ogoni case, the litigation in the U.S. is very, very important, very useful, because I think personally that companies operating in countries like Nigeria should be held liable, even in their own countries, for certain abuses or violations wherever they operate. I know there could be issues about sovereignty and jurisdiction and all that, but the reality has been that the Nigerian legal process is very slow, highly compromised, and so not very useful. A case in the U.S. will help bring some pressure on the Nigerian judiciary to take their own responsibilities more seriously. Having said so, we also have to recognize that even in Nigeria, there have been some major landmark cases and decisions. For example, some communities went to court to ask the Federal High Court to declare gas flaring illegal. And the Federal High Court agreed that gas flaring was an illegality and ordered Shell to stop gas flaring. That was in 2005. This is 2009. No gas flares have been stopped, mostly because Shell is appealing, but also because the state has failed to enforce that judgment. So, whatever opportunities or that exists internationally to hold entities and governments accountable and liable is very welcome. We also need to continue the work that open society and other institutions, doing to try to strengthen the international instrument for international redress mechanisms out there. Some of these cases are precedent setting, just to say it is possible it has been done somewhere. So to that extent, it's I consider it very useful.
I think he didn't leave anything for me to say.
No. There are no more questions. I think just like to thank all the panelists for their contributions, for taking the time to come and be with us.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for coming and participating. And hope to see you in future events that Revenue Watch will have on Nigeria and other issues on governance of oil and gas and minerals. Thank you.
Thank you.